It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, one of Wisconsin's wealthiest residents is leading an effort to build a new charter school in Beloit. We'll find out how parents and teachers there are reacting to the plan and what it could mean for kids. First, over the last several months, a lot of organizations and businesses have released statements of solidarity around the Black Lives Matter movement and racial justice protests in connection with the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others by police officers. The statements came from all kinds of organizations, including academic institutions and scientific societies. Our next guests want to know, what are those groups planning to do to follow up on those statements? Fernando Tormos-Aponte is an assistant professor of public policy and political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He wrote a recent piece in Scientific American titled, On Racial Justice, Statements Are Not Enough. Fernando, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Erica Marin Spiota is professor of geography at UW-Madison. Erica is on the Leadership Council of the Earth Science Women's Network and lead principal investigator for Advanced Geo. Erica, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Fernando, let's start with you and this piece. You wrote that academic institutions need to address how they, quote, perpetuate systems of racial oppression, end quote. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Definitely. Look, for us who are affiliated to some kind of scientific organization, society, or institution, when we got statements of this nature, we were left wondering, what does this mean? Will they actually do something beyond just saying something? And will they address the kinds of problems that they have within their own institutions? So we know that these institutions are often very hostile places for scholars of color, and particularly Black scholars and Black women scholars, Black non-gender binary scholars. So these institutions are now saying that they're recognizing systemic oppression in the United States through some of these statements. And a lot of folks are wondering, well, how are you going to address the systemic oppression that is found within your own institution?
Erica, you're a co-signer of a Change.org petition that was titled Call for a Robust Anti-Racism Plan for the Geosciences. Do you have a sense of, I don't know, skepticism, I guess, when you see a statement coming out from a research group or a university about whether they would take action to follow up on the statements?
Yeah, I think similarly to what Fernando mentioned, a lot of our societies in the geosciences put out statements, and some of them were stronger than others. And so, you know, the community responded with petitions, with demands for specific actions to follow up on those statements of solidarity.
And Fernando, what kind of specific actions are you hoping to see from, you know, academic institutions and the groups that bring together people within a similar field?
There's a range of actions that scientific institutions and organizations can take, one of which is not to take any sort of negative actions and have any kind of repercussion over those who choose to mobilize. So we know that sometimes scholars who become active in social justice struggles are subject to some kind of disciplinary measure. So instead of repressing mobilization, a lot of scholars are calling on their scientific societies, institutions, and organizations to embrace mobilization. And it matters, right? We know that, for instance, students don't vote that much, particularly STEM students. They can help get students registered to vote. They can support the social justice work and civic engagement work of scholars by changing their tenure and promotion guidelines, by allocating funds for this kind of work, by recognizing the value of this work, by recognizing fields that are dedicated to the study of Black political and social life, like Black studies or American studies, African-American studies, Africana studies. There are a range of options that they can choose to take. And one of the things that that a lot of scholars have said is that inaction is a form of action in itself, right? Inaction is a policy. And insofar as these institutions don't do something, they are choosing to abide by the status quo, which we now know, and we have known for a while, that it is unjust, it is unequal.
Erica, I know there's a concern in many fields, particularly in the sciences, I think, about a lack of diversity. And that that petition I mentioned on geosciences said that field had a particular problem. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So the petition you mentioned, and I also want to mention, there's actually two main petitions for the geosciences. And one of the reasons the geosciences is kind of is involved is because it's one of the least diverse fields of STEM, especially when we're looking at kind of the representation of racial and ethnic groups. So it's majority white and majority white male dominated organization. And there's been a lot of efforts in the geosciences in the last years to increase diversity. And a lot of those actions have focused more on gender diversity. And so we've actually seen an increase in the representation of women, for example, but it's mostly been white women. And so now there's really a lot more recognition and efforts that, you know, the representation of, you know, for example, Black students, Black scholars in the geosciences has not actually changed in the last 40 years. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done.
We're talking to Erica Marin-Spayota, professor of geography at UW-Madison, and Fernando Tormos-Aponte from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, political scientist there. We're talking about their calls for colleges, universities, and organizations, scientific and research organizations, to follow up statements they've made about racial justice and equality with some concrete action. Erica, can you talk some about the obstacles that are out there in the path of people, I guess primarily people of color, as they try to break into fields that are historically almost overwhelmingly white?
Yeah, so there's a long list of obstacles, and there's actually a lot of research kind of documenting, you know, inherent bias in our processes of admissions, recruitment, retention from the undergraduate level up to the faculty level. And as Fernando mentioned earlier, there's also, you know, it's not just kind of implicit bias, which a lot of people have focused on, but there's actually, you know, often exclusionary behaviors that lead to, you know, lived experiences of hostile climates in the geosciences. And some of the challenges in the geosciences specifically is, you know, as a very male-dominated kind of discipline, it has a specific culture that's not always welcoming to, you know, people of different gender identities and people who don't conform to kind of the rugged stereotype of, you know, the geologist who's out, you know, rugged geologist in the field who loves to camp and, you know, loves to dig up rocks. And so there's actually been a lot of efforts that is reflected in recent conversations in social media about, you know, the experiences of Christian Cooper, right, in Central Park in New York State, just about the safety of being a person of color, you know, being a person of a gender minority in the field, in field environments. So those are some of the challenges specific to the geosciences. But, you know, a lot of these kind of, you know, just bias in the systems and the processes, you know, are shared by, you know, not just STEM disciplines, but outside of STEM as well.
Fernando, I've heard the argument in conversations like these over the like many years they've been going on now, the idea that, you know, a scientific field or research field is essentially meritocratic. If you do good work, you're going to rise to the top. What would you say to that that statement?
Well, ironically, there is research now that shows that a lot of the creativity and innovation comes from a diverse group of folks within academia, but it is less likely to be recognized as such as creativity and innovation when it comes from underrepresented scholars. So this meritocracy does not allocate value to the work of everyone equally. There are those who are more likely to be recognized for their innovations, for their research than others, right? So, there are a lot of folks who I argue, who does this meritocracy work for?
And Erica, you have been doing work, including work with the group Advanced Geo. I think that's focusing on women in particular. Can you talk about maybe some concrete success stories you've seen out there?
Yeah, so Advanced Geo is funded by the National Science Foundation to improve workplace climate. And we started working on sexual harassment in the geosciences, which is also a huge problem that has gained a lot of public attention in the last couple of years, and recognize really quickly that sexual harassment does not happen in a vacuum. And we have to really think about harassment more broadly and how it affects different identities and thinking about hostile behavior. So that's kind of what we've been focusing on and working with some of the main geoscience societies. And I think one of the successes that I've seen in the geoscience is, you know, recently a lot of societies, the American Geophysical Union was the first to revise their code of conduct to include harassment, discrimination, and bullying under the definition of research misconduct. And so one of the recent petitions, the change.org, that was led by Hendrat Ali, who's a professor at Fort Hays State University, actually calls for these codes of ethics to, you know, even broaden even more and incorporate not just, you know, discrimination, but actually specific language about anti-racism.
We're talking about academic institutions and scientific and other research societies and what they could do to turn the tide against racism in society at large and within their own ranks. Our guests are Fernando Torma-Zapante from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and Erica Marin-Spiota of UW-Madison. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this part of your life? Do you have experience in an academic or research setting, maybe as a person of color yourself, having encountered some of our guests are talking about? Do you have ideas for solutions or questions for our guests about what they've encountered, what they're working on, what their hopes are? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Professors Erica Marin-Spiota and Fernando Torma-Zapante. They say that colleges, universities, and scientific organizations need to do more to take action on issues of racism. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in a STEM field yourself? Do you have some of these same concerns maybe at your workplace or in your profession? If you work in an academic setting, what is going on your campus to try to tackle some of these issues? Do you feel like there's a more of an urgent focus on this right now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Erica, can you speak to some of what you see going on here in Wisconsin with efforts to either fresh efforts over the last couple of months or over the years to tackle some of these problems?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, there's, I think, been a lot of efforts over the years, but more recently, a lot more commitment, which has been exciting to see. For example, the Division of Diversity, Equity, and Educational Achievement, now run by Cheryl Gittins on campus, has, you know, over the summer held several listening sessions with community leaders, both on campus and off campus. And so trying to build partnerships across the community, I think, has been really powerful way to kind of bring attention to, you know, racism that students are experiencing on campus as well as off campus. And our chancellor, Rebecca Blank, sent an email out to campus last week outlining some new initiatives. And some of those include, you know, more research funding to support research into race in the United States, as well as, you know, thinking about including commitments to community engaged scholarship and scholarly activities to increase diversity, equity, and inclusion as considerations for tenure.
Fernando, would you be willing to share some of your own experience coming up as a researcher in the U.S., some of what you saw and lived through that made you want to pursue not just research and teaching, but also racial justice within your field?
Yes, definitely. I mean, in political science, you have the field of race and ethnicity and politics. And for a long time, this field has had to struggle to really make a claim for its legitimacy within the broader field of political science. Some folks call the research that people do on race, ethnicity, and politics me-search, even though when white scholars study white problems, they're not told that they study me-search, right? So a lot of folks have a lot of challenge building a career on the study of these issues, despite the fact that these are issues that are important in our current times, right? We are witnessing perhaps one of the largest movements in our history unfold during this time in the middle of a pandemic. People are willing to take risks over protesting for others. And guess what? The people who are poised to study this, to do the research on this, to insert some insight into our news cycle about this, have been systematically marginalized in their field.
Eric, I want to get your thought on one thing I've seen in the scientific community, a concern that when people from, say, the United States are doing international research, say, in Africa or South America in particular, and not building research partnerships and treating, you know, the local people they're working with there as equal partners, and then something comes along like, say, a global pandemic, and they can't keep traveling there, they're losing that research. We're actually losing science because we're not bringing in this, in this case, geographically diverse group of researchers. Is that something you've seen in the fields you work with?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's actually a term for that called helicopter research. You know, and for example, I actually do a lot of my research outside of the mainland United States. And so there's definitely been a big push, especially more recently, for, you know, building local collaborations, you know, and not just coming in, you know, from the United States as an expert or believing you're an expert without recognizing that there's often, you know, a lot of long history of kind of knowledge building and understanding of the ecosystems or the processes that we're studying. And so, you know, that's definitely part of the big conversations in the sciences is, you know, how do we not do this colonial type research?
We're talking to Erica Marin-Spiota, professor of geography at UW-Madison, and Fernando Tormoza-Ponte, assistant professor of public policy and political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. They've both joined calls for academic institutions, the colleges and universities, and also research organizations, professional groups of scientists and other researchers to tackle issues of racism, not just with statements, but with more actions. Fernando, I've seen the concern sometimes that, you know, at a business or a university or whatever, concerns are raised, a diversity officer is appointed, and that's the end of the story. And it's just kind of like a token solution to the problem. Do you worry that that's going to come out of, you know, what's going on in 2020?
Definitely. You know, oftentimes diversity officers are not given the resources that they need to address the problems that they are tasked with addressing. And oftentimes when they are unable to address these problems, they're fired, right? And this is part of the problem. This is why these problems are not addressed. It's oftentimes what we see is that when issues like these arise, there's a committee or a council or some consulting firm retained to address this problem, but little is actually done. So a lot of folks are really looking at some of these statements and saying, oh, no, not another committee that I'm going to have to serve on and actually take the burden for addressing the problems that you created. So folks are saying instead of just bringing people and trying to do all this consulting and create some new committee and new councils of that nature, how about we change hiring practices, retention practices, to perhaps fund community-oriented research and engagement, to invest in research that actually manages to improve Black lives, to perhaps close the racial wage gap between Black and other races of scholars. So all of these are tangible things that could be done that go beyond just allocating all responsibility for addressing these major systemic issues on one diversity officer.
Erica, I've seen some concerns that even if the perfect solutions are found at the university level, the professional organization level, there's still worries about what's happening, you know, in pre-kindergarten, in elementary schools, things that places where maybe those kids of color, the girls, maybe even low-income people are steered away from going into these scientific and research fields. Do you see that being part of the solution?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to really start much earlier when we start thinking about the problems of representation and participation in STEM more broadly, and just thinking about, you know, kind of race, not just sexism, but also racism that is, you know, experienced by children of color at very early stages, right? And there's, you know, data of that happening in Wisconsin with huge gaps in how students of different races are treated. So there's a lot of work to be done across all levels of education, but also not just within education, but our general society. And I'm a little bit more optimistic, maybe, that I think, you know, rather than just forming one committee, I think we're at a different moment right now. And there's so much movement and a lot of this movement being led, you know, by young students, young people out in the streets, that I think people are listening. And I think we're starting to see kind of a recognition that we need to address these problems at multiple levels, right, and across all facets of society. So I'm hopeful that we'll start seeing some changes coming forward.
Yeah, along those lines, Fernando, there have been calls like this, certainly at least since the 1960s and before that, I'm sure. But do you feel like this time is different in some ways? Do you see some kind of momentum building here?
I certainly do. I mean, the kind of risks that people are willing to take to go out during a deadly pandemic to protest for Black lives, I don't think we've ever seen something like that. And that certainly says something. The kind of public opinion polls that we're seeing, where a lot of people are actually in agreement with some of the proposals of this movement, some of the demands of this movement, you know, that matters. That drives social change. So I think in the coming months, in the coming years, we're going to witness even more change. But I'll tell you what, change is already happening. Because right at this moment, as we're talking, and for the past month or so, every one of these organizations, scientific institutions, have had to have their own reckoning with race. They've had to have some kind of internal discussion, as bad as it may be, on what they will say and what they will do. That process in itself has some long-term pedagogical effects. People are now going to be more aware of this, and the way in which they look at this is going to change for a long time.
And very briefly, Erica, just in our last 30 seconds, do you feel that sense of optimism?
I do, and I would say absolutely. We're having conversations in, you know, some of the least diverse corners of science that I've never seen before, and I could not imagine we would be having. And so I think it's going to be very difficult for anybody, right, in the sciences to say, this isn't a problem. I didn't know this was a problem. So I am optimistic.
Erica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Fernando, thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking to UW-Madison Professor of Geography Erica Marin-Spillota and Fernando Tormos-Aponte, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We talked to them today about their calls for and ideas for how colleges and scientific organizations can work to tackle issues of racism. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about the debate in Beloit over a proposed charter school funded by one of Wisconsin's wealthiest residents, in large part. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are a lot of fish in the sea, and they're smarter and more interesting than we might think. A marine biologist joins us for a shoal's eye view of the world's most interesting fish species. First, a proposed charter school in Beloit has residents debating over how to provide the best education for their kids and improve a struggling public school district. The Lincoln Academy Charter School is being funded by a group of local business leaders called the Beloit 200, led by billionaire CEO and major Republican Party donor Diane Hendricks. While some think it'll provide an important alternative for students currently in public schools, others worry about the impact it'll have on the district and a lack of accountability if the new school opens up. Ruth Conniff is editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner. She recently wrote a two-part story on the Lincoln Academy. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, give us about the basics on the plans for this Lincoln Academy.
So the Lincoln Academy is a proposed charter school, and it is applying to the UW System's Office of Educational Opportunity to grant the charter. And between now and September, that office will decide whether or not to give final approval to the new school. Meanwhile, the school is already breaking ground on land owned by Hendricks Properties in Beloit. And, you know, the idea is to have this very beautiful, shiny, state-of-the-art school that will ultimately serve about 700 kids, kindergarten through high school, and we'll connect them with jobs. There's a big focus on careers, developing ideas about careers, doing internships at local employers. And I think what I found so fascinating about this story is that, I mean, first of all, Diane Hendricks, who is a huge force in Republican politics in Wisconsin, but really became known because in a documentary film, she was caught on film with Scott Walker, and he said he was going to divide and conquer the state. She was asking if we'll ever be a right-to-work state and what she could do to help. She's also a huge force in Beloit. She's a major philanthropist. She's basically remade the downtown. And her vision of the future for kids there is colliding with public school advocates in Beloit who are concerned that this school, as a publicly funded charter school, will take about 10%. In fact, it'll take 10% of the district's budget away when it's got all its kids over the next few years. And that it represents sort of the next step, as the city council vice president said, in divide and conquer, that she's out to destroy the public school system. So on the one hand, there's something really, there's sort of this big gift from a philanthropist who's done a lot for her hometown. And on the other hand, you know, you have this drama of politics in Wisconsin playing out in this town of 35,000 people. It was a major industrial hub, was a place where a lot of African-American people came during the Great Migration and worked in factories, all but two of which are now closed. There's a real question about what is the future for kids in our, you know, our increasingly manufacturing lean economy, in a place where there used to be middle class family supporting jobs in manufacturing. So what is the vision? And how do you do something about that? And is it a public project that involves the public school system, or is it a job for a philanthropist to do privately? And what does that mean for the community? So there's just a lot of interesting aspects to this story.
One thing that a lot of people you talked to agreed on, whether or not they agreed about this academy, was Beloit schools, they think, could do better. Can you set the scene for us with the district as it stands now?
So the Beloit School District has had a lot of struggles in recent years, and it really came to a head with the last superintendent. There's a new superintendent now, but Stanley Monroe, who was the former superintendent, resigned in the wake of multiple accusations against him of bullying and intimidating staff, and then later retaliating against people who complained about him. The school board got rid of him. And it's a high poverty, majority-minority school district. It serves a population that includes 71.5% economically disadvantaged students. It's also in Rock County, which has a huge number of kids, the most in the state, who have suffered early childhood trauma. So you have a school district that has a lot of challenges to meet and has had some struggles meeting them. The most recent Department of Public Instruction school report card showed that the overall grade for the school district meets few expectations. But on the other hand, you have a lot of interesting projects. I met a guy who's running a community garden near an elementary school that's right in the district where this new charter school is planned to go, and has been supplying the neighborhood with free organic food and having kids come. They're building an outdoor classroom. The Boys and Girls Club is involved. There's kind of a community spirit in Beloit and a lot of longtime Beloit residents who really feel that the district has been, has gotten a black eye, and rightly so in some instances, but also because it has these challenges and it's serving these low-income kids, really needs more support, not a drain of resources.
Yeah, this is a debate that's gone on in Milwaukee first and then elsewhere around the country. If you've got a district that needs to improve, can you do it by having this charter that's sort of outside the normal operating procedure, and then that sets an example for the rest? Or do you need to work with what you've got? How do you see that argument playing out among the people you talk to in Beloit?
I think fundamentally the argument is this school, by serving 700 kids, going to further impoverish the rest of the 7,000 kids in the district who are not going to be able to go to this school even if they want to? Or is it going to offer an opportunity in a place where people have been feeling stuck, and, you know, God bless them, let them do that, and maybe some of their practices that they discover will be replicated? That's the idea of charter schools. They're supposed to be, their best practices are supposed to ultimately be replicated by the rest of the public schools. I mean, the problem is the idea of scarcity here is that the resources that are coming out of the district, a lot of people argue the Hendricks Family Foundation, which is behind this project, has plenty of money and could run a private school without taking funds out of the district. So why not do it that way? And then the other big point of debate is that because the school is what's called a non-instrumentality charter, there's no accountability to the local school board. And as one school board member described it to me, it feels like they're making an end run by going to Madison and getting their charter approved here. And then, you know, meanwhile in Beloit, local people don't elect anybody who's going to oversee how the school does.
Yeah, who would be in charge of this school then if it's not the school board?
The UW Systems Office of Educational Opportunity. So they have, I mean, there's an interesting, and it's publicly available, the application and the responses from the UW system, where they say things like, you know, the discipline policy for this school as planned seems overly punitive. You know, it's not clear exactly what the day-to-day experience will be for kids. The curriculum needs to be further clarified. You know, it's there's a lot of talk about how great it'll be to connect kids with careers from early on, but it's not clear exactly what the details are and how well the school will perform. So, you know, first of all, they have to answer those questions before they get approval in September. And then, you know, it'll be a question as they hire staff. You know, one of the objections to the school that was raised by a Beloit professor I interviewed was that it's really white business leaders who came up with this idea. And it appears to be, although they've made a commitment to diversity, a mostly white leadership team that's launched this whole thing. And they're talking about serving mostly minority kids. So there's a question that's raised in the application by the UW that says, you know, is this a culturally sensitive program? It looks like communication with parents is a one-way street. There's a lot of expectations being put on parents, but it's not clear that there's really a sense of connecting with people where they are and, you know, working with a community from a base of knowledge of that community. So all of that is going to become more clear as the school moves forward, as I think it likely will.
We'll watch for that decision coming up this fall. Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner. She joined us to talk about a debate in Beloit over the proposed Lincoln Academy that would be a charter school funded in part by billionaire Diane Hendricks. Coming up, fish lead much more complex lives than we may give them credit for. A marine biologist joins the show to share some of the latest info about life under the sea and some of the strange species out there. Strange from a human perspective, anyway. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling in favor of Native American tribes could set a precedent for the relationship between tribes and federal, state, and local governments. First, if your primary connection with fish is through your local Friday Fish Fry, our next guest would like to help expand our undersea horizons and see fish for what she says they really are, complex, social, intelligent animals. Marine biologist, writer, and broadcaster Helen Scales teaches in Cambridge in the UK. Her books include Spirals in Time and her latest, just out in paperback, Eye of the Shoal, a fish watcher's guide to life, the ocean, and everything. Helen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Well, you are really into fish now. Can you tell about your origin story, though? You were initially interested in seeing, I believe, some sea otters.
Yeah, that's right. So I was always a nature kid growing up. I loved being outside. I loved the great outdoors. I loved nature in a kind of big, general, wild way. But yeah, in my kind of early teens, I was a big sea otter fan, really big sea otter fan. And I came on this wonderful trip to California, the first time I'd ever been to the United States. My parents took me on this trip of a lifetime. And we were in kind of central California, looking out over the sea. And there were sea otters playing in the kelp. And I loved it. They were wonderful. They were as wonderful as I was hoping. But then a kind of unexpected thing happened, which I think more like reflecting on later, I look back and realized maybe that was what happened to me. The fish in me began while I was there. And as well as watching sea otters, I noticed these amazing shoals of fish were being chased around by another mammal of the oceans, seals. There were these wonderful, I think maybe sea lions actually, chasing these shoals of fish around. And I was really mesmerized just by the shape and the movement of these balls of fish that were splitting apart and coming back together, and the sea lions were chasing and chasing. And as far as I could tell, they weren't actually eating any of these fish. And yeah, it's just kind of an unexpected moment for me, I think, especially looking back on it, I think, and seeing that I sort of was really drawn to those simpler creatures, I guess, in some ways, these fish compared to the mammals, which are more like myself. And it wasn't much longer after that I started learning to scuba dive. And then after that, just wanted to spend as much time as I could down beneath the waves with the fish.
And in this book, you're trying to get the rest of us as excited about fish as you are. And that's a tall order, I think, because we've, you know, fish, okay, we'll eat them. We'll have them as mildly entertaining, low-maintenance pets. But you say there's a lot more under the sea and lake or whatever when it comes to fish. Can you share some of that excitement with us?
Yeah, I guess that really is the point of the book, is I felt incredibly drawn to these animals when I first saw them in their own environment. When the first time I was on a dive and I saw one little fish, and I suddenly felt like I was in its world. I was in this three-dimensional space, which is completely different to the world I knew. And this wonderful animal was just hovering in front of me. And I just felt myself wanting to know more about its life and how it lives in this very strange realm that I know nothing about. But I think that's the deal with fish, is that for all these reasons that they're food and that they live in this other world that we don't inhabit, it's very easy to think of them as being very different to ourselves, to us land-dwelling vertebrates that walk around and breathe the air. And because fish are so different when we don't see them so much, I think it is really easy to overlook them and to not realize just how diverse they are and how intelligent they are and how beautiful they can be. And I guess that's the idea of the book, really, is to look under the waves, to encourage people actually in real life or just through the book through TV shows, everything else, to stick your head beneath the waterline and look into the world of the fish and begin to really see and appreciate that there's so much more going on than we give them credit for.
You use the word intelligent, and that's one of the things that surprised me, I got to say, the most about your book, that there's a lot more intelligence among fish and a lot more social, observable social behavior among groups of fish than I would have thought. Can you talk about what we've learned about fish social life?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is one of the most important aspects, actually, that it's really, we really do think of like generalization of a fish is this kind of tiny-brained, you know, cold-blooded kind of dumb thing that doesn't feel pain, that doesn't have these sort of social interactions as we might imagine for birds or for mammals. But fish do this. And the more we look and the more we dive and we spend time with fish and study them, we see some really cool things happening. And we've definitely been underestimating the intelligence of fish, I think. And there's some really, really cool examples. One of my favorite is this little thing called the cleaner wrasse, this little tiny fish about the size of your forefinger and your thumb. That's about the size it would be. And these guys are the cleaners of coral reefs. So all around the world, you'll see these little things swimming around, and they pick clean other fish. They pick off parasites and bits of dead skin. But in order to be able to do that, they actually have to be pretty intelligent. For simple things like they don't want to march straight up to a fish that could potentially eat them and start cleaning them and picking off the parasites, knowing that actually, you know, this is a bigger fish that's a predator. So they know how to control the behavior of those other fish by giving them a massage. They actually give them a little back rub to say, this is okay, I'm just going to clean you here, don't eat me. And these tiny fish, which have tiny brains, have evolved really complex social lives. They've learned how to interact with these other species of fish and to basically advertise their services as the cleaners. And they're really important. Without those little fish, the other fish, the bigger fish, would get sick. They would get really, really sick. And we know that from studies we've seen. If there's no cleaners, then the reef is just not doing as well. But intelligence and smart behavior is a really key part of their success as these vital little cleaning fish. And you wouldn't really guess that from something that looks so small and kind of insignificant. They're really cool things.
We're talking to marine biologist Helen Scales about her book, Eye of the Shoal. Helen, one personal interest of mine is I think of fish, if you can define fish in one way, it's that they have gills and they don't have lungs, which is true, except when it isn't. There are fish with lungs, including lungfish. Why are there some fish with lungs?
It's confusing, isn't it? Fish are really slippery things to define. And yeah, then you go find something like a lungfish and everything gets a bit more complicated. But actually, I mean, kind of the reason that fish do have features like that is they've been around for a long time, and they were the first vertebrates that evolved way before any of us lot that live out here on land. And in some ways, you could say that all the other vertebrates, the reptiles, the birds, the mammals, the amphibians, all of us guys, evolved from fish. So we're highly evolved fish, if you like. We share common ancestors with fish way back. And so some of those features, things like, well, it's the swim bladder that fish have, this balloon of air, which most fish use to keep themselves buoyant underwater. But it does function as a lung in some fish too. And that really could be a sort of a precursor to the lungs that we have. It's not quite directly, like it doesn't quite work the same way, but we certainly share an ancestor that had the beginnings of what in our lineage became lungs, and then for these fish, they have lungs too. And it does make sense. They live in water, but the lungfish live often in quite stagnant water that doesn't have much oxygen in it. So being able to actually take a lungful of air is pretty helpful. And the really cool thing that lungfish do is that if the water dries out completely, they can chew themselves a burrow in the mud of the river, and they crawl into their little burrow, seal themselves off, and for up to 4 years they can survive, and they can be absorbing oxygen from the air. And that's pretty amazing, a fish that can live for 4 years out of water.
You've been swimming with a lot of different kinds of fish in places all over the world. Is there one that would be on your wish list or dream list? Maybe even one that would be physically difficult for a human to swim around with?
Oh, that's such a good question. That really is. I guess I would have to go, if I'm allowed to really bend the rules a bit, I would love to go swimming with some of the ones that live in the very deepest parts of the ocean. There's no way I would physically be able to do that, I don't think. But if that were possible, there are just some of the most extraordinary and strange fish, and all of the animals really that live in the deep sea are pretty wacky. But I would love to see something like just one of the anglerfish, one of the ones that have these amazing abilities to glow in the dark. Oh, I'd love to swim with a fish that glows in the dark. They have these lures that dangle down in front of their mouths to attract prey. Yes, please. I'd like to see one of those. That would be amazing.
And did I read you right? Some of these deep sea fish, there are some species where there are probably trillions on this earth.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So we're talking about these wonderful, fairly small fish about the size of a sardine or an anchovy. They look sort of similar. Those two also have the ability to light up. They're bioluminescent. And yeah, we think there are estimates that they do occur in their trillions, in the deep ocean, open water. So they live in what we call the twilight zone, about 1,000 meters, 3,000 feet roughly down, where there's just a little bit of light coming down still from the sun. Mostly it's a kind of dark, deep blue color, hence the twilight. And every night they all will rush up to the surface of the sea to feed in the darkness. And they are just, it's the biggest migration of vertebrates on the planet. We have this enormous movement of these fish coming up. And then as the sun rises in the morning, they go back down to hide in the dark depths again. And yeah, there are billions and trillions of these fish. And hundreds of species. We're still finding new species of these things, still working out how important they are. It's quite likely they play a key role in the climate, that they help to bring carbon down into the deep, so that this is helping us with climate change potentially, and presumably food for a whole bunch of other animals too. So they're really important fish, and I would love to see that too. Yeah, could I swim with those as well, please? That would be great.
Well, in our last minute or so, is there a particular fish myth you'd like to break for us?
Oh, that's a really good question. I guess I would really like to bust the myth, or continue to bust the myth. People have done it before me, but people also do still keep believing this idea that fish have very short memories. I don't know if you've heard of this idea of maybe that a goldfish has a 7-second memory, or sometimes a 9-second, or whatever, not a long memory at all. But this is definitely not true. I mean, it's true that it's hard to know what's going on in the mind of a goldfish or a little fish that's swimming around an aquarium, but they can learn things. They can remember things. If you have pet fish, you might already have found out that actually they learn pretty quickly where the time that you're feeding them and the place in the tank. They will congregate and wait for their food. They know it's food time. And studies are showing that fish can remember things for ages. I mean, sharks are pretty smart. They can remember things for years. They can learn. They can make friends. They have particular other sharks they like to hang out with. So I guess that really does reflect on the more complex lives these fish lead. And they're doing much more than we really give them credit for. And they can remember stuff for sure. Definitely for longer than 7 seconds.
Helen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. It's been all my pleasure. Thank you.
That's UK-based marine biologist Helen Scales. We talked to her today about her book. It's called Eye of the Shoal, A Fish Watcher's Guide to Life, the Ocean, and Everything. Well, I know we have a lot of, you know, bird watchers out there listening right now and around the state of Wisconsin. Do you consider yourself a fish watcher? Do you go snorkeling in Wisconsin, or Have you traveled around the world maybe to go snorkeling and see some really cool fish in really cool places? You can let us know, tell us your fish watching story or your fishing story, I guess. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR and share some pictures, maybe even videos while you're there. Good news for fans of the night sky. There's a new visitor, and you don't have to wait up late to see it. Even better news, if you miss it this time around, you only have to wait 6,800 years for another chance. The comet Neowise has been in the headlines lately. It's a rare visit from the 3-mile-wide ball of ice and dust. According to space.com, the best time to see it is a while after sundown when you see the first stars starting to appear in the sky. Then look ye to the northwest, and you should be able to spot it below the Big Dipper. You could see it with the naked eye, but you could see it even better with a telescope or even binoculars. Better still, get away from city lights, as always, for the night sky to get a better view of this comet. Neowise has a long elliptical orbit that takes it out to the Oort cloud. That's way out in the far reaches of the solar system. And it's on a return trip right now after coming closer to the sun than the planet Mercury. Because of that long orbit, it's not going to be back in Earth's neighborhood until about the year 8820. So get that on your calendar. Also on your calendar, we're going to talk more about that comet and other cool stuff to see in the night sky through the rest of this summer. That'll be tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time. Keep watching the skies. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.